with Gav Thompson. Hello, welcome to the Do Lectures podcast with me, Gav Thompson. This is episode 3 of season 4, Living Your Best Life. We talk to people who are, quite frankly, living their best life. And today, we speak to Helen McGinn. Helen has an amazing story. I think her career found her. She started off life in the wine industry. She then started writing about wine. She then wrote a blog and then a book called The Knackered Mother's Wine Club. She then started appearing on TV a lot. She is the weekly wine expert for Saturday Kitchen. And most interestingly, she then started writing fiction. And she's published 3 novels, done very well. And yeah, her star seems to be in the ascendance. She is a lovely person. She is living her best life. But she has a story that actually has some horrible tragedy in it. And it's... Well, have a listen, but it's sobering stuff. And on that note, for some reason, when I was doing the podcast, I thought with Helen that I would drink wine when I was talking to her. And you may be able to tell as we go through it that I was rather enjoying the idea of drinking wine with my guests. So apologies for that. Or not. Anyway. Please sit back, put your feet up, grab a coffee or a glass of wine, and listen to Helen McGinn of the Knackered Mother's Wine Club talking about living her best life. Thank you so much for joining me today, Helen McGinn. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me, Gab.
So look, a couple of things. Obviously, we're here to talk about living your best life, of which I think for most people, they look at you and go, oh my gosh, she is living her best life. There's a couple of things I need to just clear up. When I've seen you on the screen recently... I've seen you and Gary Barlow, which we'll come back to, because that's that's a beautiful thing. But I have to be honest, when I look at you in the past, I've seen Rolf Harris. You can respond.
Okay.
this is not what we prepared shocked. Earlier. Yeah, I mean, you know, why would that be a good thing? So I once went. This is a massive overshare, but. I went on one of those sort of sailing boats in your kind of 20s, like post-gap year, around Australia. And on my own, it's like 25, 30 people. And basically what happened is no one spoke to me for 2 days. Yeah, I know, it was horrible. Now, if you're me, you kind of go, that could happen. But it was weird because they really didn't like me. And it turns out that when we join the boat and we do that, sit around the boat and go, who you are, some genius, funny English guy who I'd never met before had said to everyone behind my back that I was Rolf Harris's son. I was his love child, which is not a great intro. And this was just before he was done for all his things he was done for. Anyway, I spent 2 days wondering why no one spoke to me, and then day two, it transpired that everyone thought I was Rolf Harris's kid. And as well as getting over that, we ended up having quite a long chat about Rolf Harris. And in the conversation, somebody said something which has always stuck with me, which is Rolf Harris's mantra, aside from all the weird stuff, was find your obsession, then make it your profession. Mm-hmm. And again, parking all the weird stuff with Rolf, I thought that's kind of actually quite good sound advice. And when I looked at you and still look at you, I'm going, well, you've taken your obsession, which is you're a knackered mother and you like wine, and you've turned it into a business. And that's the most long-winded intro I'll ever give to any guest ever on my podcast. And also the least appropriate and the most revealing and the one that I'm probably least proud of. However, it is authentic, Kels. So What a long way of saying I admire you for taking something you're interested in.
Yeah.
Wine and being a knackered mum and turning it into your profession.
Yeah.
Please, A, forgive me for such a clumsy intro, but B, tell me, how did you go from being a knackered mother to somebody that's now your career?
Well, first of all, I love that introduction. I thought it was beautiful, Gav. Thank you very much. And I'm really glad you did tell me that, actually, that soundbite, because there's another one that I read many years ago that goes something like, do what you love and you'll never have to do a hard day's work in your life, which I think is selling us. That's not right, because you can do what you love. It's still going to be hard work. Mm. It's just,
we can all be rude about Rolf Harris, and we should. Yeah. But, you know, if he did say that, and I haven't researched it, I think it is his. I think it's a lovely thought, and let's take that and let's own it and dance with it. And, you've taken your obsession, you made your profession.
I have.
How did you do that?
So my obsession with wine started kind of quite late-ish. I mean, it was not like I came from a wine family, other than they drink lots of it and love it, but it wasn't a kind of predetermined career path by any means. I joined a wine society at university because it was the cheapest way to have four half glasses of wine on a Thursday night once a month. Genuinely, that's the reason I did it.
And respect. I found fully, that it, chapeau.
Found that actually it was a subject that did really interest me. I think because it involved, from as far as I could tell, it involved really brilliant people, beautiful places, and wine. And it was a fascinating subject. And once I started learning a little bit about it, I just wanted to know more. Like, it completely blew my mind that you could have the same grape and plant it in two different places, and you'd end up with two completely different wines. Like, how does that work? So that's sort of how I got into it. And I guess my sensible career, like the bit that I still feel was my proper job, was 10 years as a wine buyer for Tesco. So that really was my my kind of foundation, and it's where I got to travel the world and do meet lots of brilliant people in wine and drink lots of it, and it was wonderful. But it all came to a kind of massive halt as soon as I had my first baby, because you obviously don't think about this when you're in your 20s having a lovely time. But
House, I'm when just, I've, you, just hold on one second.
Yeah,
I just want to go back to that moment where you've graduated, and it's literally like, hands up, who wants to buy wine for a living? And you know, how do you go from that? I mean, you know, I genuinely don't understand this. I have a friend of mine, Fat Bob, who's become a very big guy, sorry, no pun intended, in the wine industry, and he literally works his way up from being a kind of delivery driver to working in a wine shop to, you know, nearly becoming a master of wine and whatever. But how do you, know what I mean? It's like that grad recruitment fair where you go, I'll be a wine buyer for Tesco. How did you get that role?
Well, I got in on a graduate placement scheme. Because, I mean, in those days, and this is mid-90s, you know, a supermarket wasn't a very glamorous place to work, especially, you know, if you were coming into it and looking at the wine industry, you'd be thinking, I want to go and work for, you know, one of the smart companies in London, which I went and knocked on all of their doors and managed to get in front of some people. Some people didn't answer, but some people did and said, oh, yeah, come and talk to us. They were very nice, but they didn't have a job. They didn't know what to do with somebody who was halfway through her degree, who was saying, I really want to come and work in wine. And they were like, well, that's great, but can you type? I'd be like, no, I mean, I could learn. it was economics and politics based. And so the idea was, I wanted them to think I was a set, you know, I would be able to kind of, you know, I'd have a commercial head on my shoulders, but that I was really, really interested in wine. I thought that would help, but actually it's very difficult to get a job in those small companies. It still is. So It was my dad who said, look, just apply to the supermarkets instead and get in that way around instead. So that's what I did. When I applied on the graduate scheme, for a year, I had to do all the horrible jobs, like all around the business. I wasn't allowed anywhere near wine for a year until I proved that I wanted to be there.
So you're not just going, hey, give me the wine. You're kind of going, okay,
no, no,
right,
no.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I did everything from shampoo to men's razors and blades to you name it. It was basically I had to learn how to be a buyer. So I did that for a year and worked in stores and worked in lots of different departments. And at the end of it, I went and knocked on the door of the guy who then ran the wine department and said, I'm still here. Can I have a job now, please? And I think he was quite surprised that I was still there. And he did give me a job in the wine department. And that's where I stayed for 10 years. And actually looking back, how lucky was I? Because it was the time when supermarkets were getting serious about their wine. They paid to put me through all my wine exams. I had 5 years of wine exams whilst I was working, plus traveling the world. So it was a very good gig indeed. And I loved every minute that I was there.
Okay, got that. Now to speed. So you then become a mum.
Yes.
What happens next?
So what happens next is I get home with this baby that suddenly, you know, I hadn't really registered the bit that, you know, you've got to look after them all the time when they're very tiny. So traveling around the world was not an option. And it wasn't, even though I was offered a part-time role there, I realized that I'd had a brilliant time there, but it was time to do something different and something that I could do around having small kids. So I was very lucky that I managed to find a role in a company that was still wine related, working with wine and supermarkets, but more on the marketing side. And it was whilst I was doing that job that I started, because I used to write all the wine back labels when I was a buyer. I loved writing the wine back labels. And I always as well, because I love being able to talk about wine in a way that I'm hoping will make people want to drink it rather than people think, what does that mean?
When you write a back label, are you allowed to sort of talk nonsense, i.e., you know, the difference between sort of succulent and bountiful? I mean, does anyone check your work when you're you know, writing a back label for a minor bottle brand in Tesco? Can you literally just drink a few bottles of it, write some nonsense, and it just appears? Does anyone? What's the editing process?
I guess that was the bit of the job that I really loved. Was my challenge was in a small space that I had to try and get across to you why you should buy that wine, where does it come from, what does it taste like, what food should you drink it with, what can you expect from it. And so if anything, I was trying really hard not to use words that are kind of fancy or you know, very whiny. I wasn't interested in that. I wanted just you to be able to pick it up and think, this sounds so delicious, I want to take it home now and drink it. That's what I.
So there wasn't a kind of internal game of bullshit bingo going on with your competitors and your team about who could get the most ridiculous phrase on the back of a bottle. No, is that my imagination?
No, I think there were some that loved doing that, and they're probably still lots floating around now. But that definitely wasn't my thing.
Whoever got the word unctuous,
yes.
Amazing.
Yeah,
just sort of what it means.
No,
I've seen it everywhere.
I know, and I mean that's the thing. You know, with what the whole language of wine can sometimes be unnecessarily complicated. And it doesn't need to be. You know, I find it amazing sometimes that the wine seems to, on the back label, try its very hardest not to sell itself to you rather than make you want to pick it up. So that was part of the challenge.
Okay, sorry, I completely interrupted with my unctuous prejudice. So what happens next?
So then, that's why I started the wine blog, because after leaving as a wine buyer, actually, I had sort of curated by accident an email that went to friends of mine that had, we, as you probably remember, we all kind of bred in batches. So there was a whole group of us who I used to email them about offers that I knew was coming up. And that the title of that email was the Knackered Mother's Wine Club, because it was just like four or five friends. We'd all have babies. I'd tell them if I knew something particularly good was on offer about wine, because they'd asked. I wasn't just being that annoying.
And that was just a kind of, that was literally kind of like a an office thing, like a, this is good and it's cheap. And I know nothing to know that this is a thumbs up opportunity.
Yes, exactly. It was, I mean, there was nothing in it for me other than thinking this is really good value. I'm probably going to be drinking it when I come to your house anyway. So there was a bit of self-interest in there, in that I wanted to make sure all my friends had nice wine.
And again, I think I do remember this. This was literally like 10 of your mates.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah,
okay. Of which, so one of them is a very good friend of mine, hence why we're talking. Yep.
There you are. Yeah, she was definitely on the list. And so then that is when one evening when I was sitting there, my husband Ross was, he was away in London one night a week working, and I had got into the habit of working myself in the evening. You know, I had three small kids then, and I would be doing a spreadsheet for this job I was doing. And one evening I had a real moment of thinking, what am I doing? I'm going to start a blog instead, a wine blog. And once a week, I'm just going to post a couple of wines on there, which means I can then write about them. That, going back to that whole back label thing, just give myself the challenge of explaining wines in a way that I hope is informative, engaging, you know, a bit more fun. And so that is how the blog started, the Knackered Mother's Wine Club. I set it up in 2 minutes. This was a time when the whole mummy blog thing was quite big. You know, I had small kids. If I was looking something up, I'd go to that rather than a textbook to see, you know, to find the answer. So that was really, I guess, my light bulb moment, although I don't want to call it a light bulb moment because I was so knackered then, but the slow realization maybe that just by putting it on a blog, then other people other than people who were related to me or friends of mine could read it. And when I started it for the first 6 months, it was, you know, it was an instant hit with at least 10 people.
which is pretty big in those days, right?
Yeah, exactly. But I do remember the first evening when I logged on, you know, I got a notification that I'd had a comment, and I went and had a look, and this comment was from somebody I didn't know who just found the blog and had a wine question or had something to say about a wine I'd recommended. And it was such a thrill realizing that this was another way of having a conversation about wine that didn't cost me anything but my own time. But it was something that I thought there's something in this.
And at that point, who was paying the rent on your side? What was your actual job?
Then I was still working part time for this wine company. So, I mean, I was very lucky that I was working mostly from home. I was working at the time as well on a very big project that was in America, but I was doing it all from here, and I was using my experience as an ex-wine buyer to do it. I had to spend a lot of time at a laptop just doing spreadsheets, and that was why I thought I need to do something else, otherwise I'm going to go mad. And that's why I started the blog. It felt like my own little personal space on the internet that I could make something with.
And then how did it become a business? What was the next bit?
I guess it went from a blog to a business about 2 years after doing the blog. I got an email from an editor who had seen the blog online. And again, this is pre-Instagram. So this is before, you know, social media was the very noisy space that it is now. And in those days, there was a trend that had just started of blogs being turned into books. But, you know, a few had been done, but not that many. And an editor saw the blog and emailed me saying, I've seen your blog. I really love it. Can we meet? I think this should be a book. And I went to meet her, you know, about a month afterwards. And she is just the most brilliant woman. Liz Goff, her name is. And we had a meeting at Pan Macmillan. I mean, I remember going to the meeting. I felt like I was having an out-of-body experience. I couldn't believe that this blog I'd set up in 2 minutes, and suddenly I was having a meeting at one of the biggest publishing houses in London. And first of all, we just, you know, within 2 seconds of meeting her, we both knew that it was going to work and it was going to be really good fun. And it took me 6 months to write that book. And the book was the Knackered Mothers Wine Club. And it was essentially, she said, just write the one wine guide that you would give to all of your friends. So that is what I did. And so it was based on the idea of the blog, but I wanted it to have longevity. So it's not individual wines. It's not recommending wines that are on the shelf because they change every year. This is just basically a guide to forming your own wine sat-nav so that when you go into a supermarket or a wine list, you'll suddenly feel a lot more confident about what you're doing and what you like and how to find stuff that you like and how not to buy bad bottles. So 6 months of writing, every Saturday morning, I used to get up, my husband would take the children out, and I would write like for about 5 or 6 hours. I would have child-free to do that, and the book came out. And once that came out, then I got a call asking if I would do a wine column in the Daily Mail, which I did for years and years and years, and I still write about drinks for them now. And so I, you know, slowly this started to build that actually I could see there was something here. More writing came my way for magazines, things like that. But I was still, at that point, to be honest, it was the Knackered Mothers bit was still a hobby. I was still doing a kind of normal part-time job. And then about 5 years into Knackered Mothers, I just had a feeling that I needed to do this. I needed to put more time into it because I was compromising it by not thinking it could be a business. And I thought, actually, it really can be. So I left my other job, jumped, didn't look down, hoped for the best, and hustled. And now, I mean, there are things that have happened that you can't force. So like the telly stuff came along. That really was somebody had seen the wine column in the paper, and it was a producer who rang me. And this is about 10 years ago. And she asked if I would go and have a meeting with a production company. They wanted a wine expert for the Alan Titchmarsh show, of all things. And so
need one of those. That's a real life problem.
Honestly, that was such a fun job. Every week I would go along and I would do a show where I would sit at the table and I'd have to match wines to whatever the celebrity chef was cooking. And I did wine tastings with everyone from Atomic Kitten to Sooty and Sweet. And
I mean, seriously, you can stop right there. At that point, you're living your best life. You go home to your kids, go, what should you do today, Mum? Well, I matched some wines with a couple of puppets who had a couple of fists up their asses.
But I do remember when I was sitting in that production meeting and we had this whole chat. I think there were two or three of them and one of me, obviously.
Well, Sooty and Sweet.
We had a chat. I just maybe they were there. I wouldn't know.
Okay.
I don't think Sooty doesn't drink, or maybe it's Sweet. Anyway, I remember thinking at some point, I'm sure somebody will ask me if I've ever done television before or something along those lines, but nobody did and nobody seemed worried about it.
What are your credentials for doing this?
Yeah. Yes. But me being me at the end of the meeting, I said it myself. I was like,
it's nuts.
Does anyone want to know if I've ever done any before? Because I haven't.
Oh my gosh, that's so
crazy.
Like,
oh no, it's fine, don't worry, it'll be fine.
Okay, when are you not living your best life at this point? You go, yeah. Okay, my work is done here, there is nowhere else to go. What?
Well, the truth is, whilst that media side was growing, the telly and the book and the writing, I did carry on a consultancy side, which was the serious bit, which was working with producers all over the world, really, who wanted to sell their wine to supermarkets, who really needed to get their kind of branding together. So I was still using the sensible stuff whilst, whilst running wholeheartedly with this whole other world
that was opening up.
Because it was so much fun. It still is so much fun. I mean, genuinely, every week when the music for Saturday Kitchen starts and I'm sitting there, I have an out-of-body experience and I have to stop myself from just literally laughing out loud because it is so fun. Still can't believe.
Well, I mean, it's you know,
it's a thing.
I stumbled across you having a drink with Gary Barlow and, you know, hello, what? I think I know Helen. What's happened in her life that she's now Gary Barlow's drinking partner at 9 a.m. on a Saturday morning.
Yeah.
So lots of boxes ticked there.
Yeah.
As you may remember, I was nearly intake that. you probably don't remember that story. It's probably one for a different podcast. But you know, I was close to being, you know, next to Gary Barlow in that drinking situation. But again, another day, another conversation. But you know, there must be a moment where you're going, bloody hell, I'm drinking wine with Gary Barlow at 9 a.m. on a Saturday. Where did it all go so right? You know, I'm living my best life. I mean, genuinely, does it get any better than that?
Well, before I talk about that, can we just go back to how you were nearly and take that? Because I can't move on from here. And
you were going to say that. Oh, my gosh. There's a story, and it's mostly untrue, that when I was in Footlights for Cambridge University, which is true, and I was in a show and a festival in 1991 or two, that I was in the show and that a guy came to audition us, who the story goes was Nigel Martin Smith, who was trying to set up a boy band on the back of, I think it was New Kids on the Block, and the story goes that he sort of was going to, you know, he had a kind of northern Manchester sort of vibe or a southern posh vibe, and he came to see the Footlights because he wanted to fill the shoes of the southern posh vibe, and he came to see our show, of which there was lots of singing and dancing, and I was wearing a kind of not many clothes, and the story goes that I was picked out and was auditioned to be in Take That, and I was, as some people say, the sixth member of Take That. Most of the above is horrifically untrue, but I'm not here to correct it, right? Because it's not, it's served me well over the years, and if people want to do their fact checking, let them fact check. They'll find that there are many flaws in that story. But it stood the test of time, and, you know, who am I to get in the way of people's dreams and fantasies? Mostly mine.
That's so, your sliding doors moment.
Exactly. So there's a part of me that whenever I see Take That, I think it could be me. And particularly Gary, because he was a bit chubby at the time, and I'm obviously quite chubby now. I mean, let's ignore the fact he's an incredibly talented songwriter and all that stuff. So, yeah, I kind of think I could have been you, Gary. And so whenever I see him, I get a little twinge of jealousy.
It could have been me.
Slash admiration. And so imagine my surprise when I turn on the telly not long ago and see you, who I feel that I know you, with Gary Barlow. And I'm going, okay, this is a sign. She has to be on the podcast. She's living her best life. And in talking to her, I'm actually interviewing Gary.
Yeah, there basically.
You go. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. One step away.
Once I've done this interview, I'm going to forward it to Gary and go, come on, mate. You're next.
It's got to do it. Yeah. That was brilliant. I absolutely loved that show because I had actually had met him before. Very briefly.
Don't show off.
This is the thing. I also do This Morning on ITV. So I had met Gary briefly, but on that show, you're like in and out. Whereas Saturday Kitchen, he was stuck in a studio with me for like, you know, an hour and a half. And it was so much fun.
But is it weird drinking wine at 9 in the morning? Or does that become very kind of normal very quickly?
Well, I have my first sip at about 7:15 in the morning because we do a full rehearsal. Yeah.
Gosh, I've not quite got there yet.
Yeah,
I'll let you know.
So he loves his wine. Gary loves his wine. He's really into his wine. He makes his own as well, not by himself. He has the help of a very good winemaker. But it was a joy, and I had a run of shows actually. That was I remember because it was Gary Barlow 1 week, and then the following week was Martin Kemp, I think, from Spandau Ballet.
Oh my gosh, yeah,
and
legend.
And by the end, it just got to the point where I really did feel like I was going to wake up in a studio on my own to find no one there but me, and it'd all been a very lovely dream.
No, you'd wake up and it'd be me next to you. Okay? That was a fucking nightmare. It's not going well.
But you saying, it's Gav. That could have been me.
That could have been me. It was. Anyway, so in conclusion, an amazing journey from being you had a obsession, you made it your profession, and actually, you know, fair play to you, Hells. I'm not an expert, but it seems like you've got to the top of your game in the kind of, you know, the populist wine. How would you describe it? Imagine you're talking to your
kids. I am supermarket wine through and through. That was my, you know, my foundation. It's where I buy my wine even now. I'd love to have a cellar full of smart stuff, but I don't. I have wine that I buy in the supermarket and I love it.
So, I've got two more tricky questions for you, but before we get to them, I've got another sort of, again, sort of chapeau, hats off moment, which is you've then managed to pivot, as we say in the kind of startup world, to becoming an author. You're now a very successful published novelist. Again, how did that come about? I mean, what? Hello? What's going on?
Well, when I wrote The Knack of Mother's Wine Club, which is, that was 10 years old just now. I wrote it, you know, over 10 years ago. Thank you. And it's still published now. And actually it got a kind of facelift a couple of years ago, and it's now The Knack of Mother's Wine Guide. And we just update it every couple of years. It's sort of fairly future-proof anyway, but I always just go through and anything that needs tweaking. And when that came out, the subtitle of that guide, as I said to you, I wanted to write the definitive, here's where you start, and this is pretty much as much as you need to know to make a big difference. And the subtitle is Everything You Need to Know About Wine and Much, Much More. So I felt like I couldn't then say, oh yeah, here's another book of all the stuff I didn't tell you. Like, that wasn't the plan. I always knew in my heart of hearts I wanted to write one wine book and not just keep kind of trotting out the same stuff but done a bit differently. That feels like that's, you know, that doesn't feel right. But I think after 10 years pretty much of talking and writing about wine for a living, and I still do now, and I don't ever want to stop doing that because I love it, but at the same time I felt myself needing to write about something else. And I'm a great reader, but I would like to clarify that I'm a great reader of very commercial fiction. I love nothing more than a Jackie Collins, a Rosamund Pilcher, a Mary Wesley, a Jilly Cooper. I mean, I grew up on that stuff and I love it.
I know where you're at, yeah.
Yes, exactly. So that is I wanted to write a book that was just a real escape. I wanted it to basically be about love, family, friends, sisters, you know, all the lovely messiness of everyday life as I know it. And so I set myself a task of writing a book, a fiction book, but I didn't tell anyone I was doing it. And a bit like the, you know, the last time around, I did it in my spare time, which is why it took me 4 years to write it. I mean, the children were a bit older by this stage, so I could find a couple of hours here and there. And so once I had written it, I said to my agent, I had an agent by then, and she'd been saying, gently prodding me, saying, you know, are we going to do another book? And by then I'd done one on cocktails, I'd done a homemade cocktail book, and I'd done one on dry drinks, very thin book, that one. And I said to her, okay, well, I have actually written this fiction novel. And even as I said it out loud, I think I've sort of felt a bit sick. And I remember giving her the manuscript and off she went. And about a week later, she came back to me and she said, you're such an idiot. Why didn't you tell me you'd written this ages ago? But the last meeting I had before lockdown was with lovely Heather, my agent, amazing woman, and with a publisher called Boldwood, who are fantastic. And the last meeting we had, we did a 3-book deal. So they bought that one and commissioned 2 more. And I'm now writing my 4th. So I did three books in 4 years, really. Well, the first one was done and then 1 a year. And now I'm doing my 4th one, so it'll be about a book a year. So, you know, I'm not the fastest writer because I have to fit it around other stuff, but I do really enjoy doing it. And there's quite a lot of wine woven into the stories, because again, I quite like the idea that you might learn or read about a new wine you haven't tried before and like the sound of it and maybe want to go and try it. So I always set some of it in a, like the three I've done so far have all been set in different cities in Italy. And the fourth one I'm writing is going to go to Greece, because I love Greek wine. So yeah, I'm basically just plying you with wine without you knowing it.
Amazing. You're living your best life. You're now a best-selling bloody novelist with your fourth novel out. It's like, hello, how did that happen? And what?
Well, so when I wrote the Knacker Mother's Wine Guide, that, you know, obviously I'd never written a book before, but I had done, by then I had done 3 years-ish of writing the blog, and I loved the process of writing. I have always loved writing and reading books, but as we clarified, not kind of hugely challenging, although, you know, I will do the odd challenging one every now and again, but, you know, I read for joy and I like books that take me away. So I loved the process of writing the Knacker Mother's Wine Club, because it was a real lesson in, like, you literally start with a blank piece of paper, but then how do you put all this knowledge you have into a book that, you know, it's you just want to make sure people are turning the pages. And that I loved doing that. I loved figuring out how to do it. And then hilariously, I remember thinking, well, fiction, how hard can it be? Because you just make it up. That's the point. You don't have to have a structure. You can go anywhere with it. But actually, it's not that easy, because you'd stare at that page for ages thinking, where do I start? What do I do? But I think I approached it in the same way as the nonfiction book, which was, I thought, right, I just need a plan. I just need like a one page plan, so I know where I'm starting and I know where I'm ending and I know roughly where I'm going on the way there. But then eventually I realized that I just had to sit down and start writing. And once I did that, again, that first story, because the first story I wrote, the first fiction book I wrote, is sort of a bit, you know, semi-autobiographical, a bit-ish, because it's a mother and two sisters. And what happens to them actually is made up, but the relationships in there are a bit based on me. I mean, so for instance, when I said to both my mother and my sister, I'm writing a fiction book and it's not you, but the character is a bit like you, and I want to make sure you're all right with that. And both of them said to me separately, this is genuine story, both of them said to me separately, they were like, okay, fine, yeah, no, that's fine. So like, who's the main character? That's all they wanted to know. who was the star? I had to say to them, actually, it's my book. Who do you think the main character is?
It's like neither of you. Gosh. So, amazing.
Yeah, so that happened really quickly. Whereas the second book, that was based on something that had actually happened to me in real life, but the characters were all completely made up. So I did it completely the other way around. And then book three, by the time I wrote book three, I really, really had fun with it. Like, for the first time, I introduced a little bit of Jeopardy, which I hadn't really done in the first two, because I didn't think that was my style of writing, but it turns out I love writing like that.
I mean, we're not going to resolve this now, and maybe it's a subject of a different podcast called, you know, how do you know what you're good at? Did anyone ever say to you, all right, Hels, you got this wine thing, you know, just keep doing the wine thing. And I'm thinking about your husband, maybe, about Ross.
Yeah.
You kind of go, keep doing the wine thing. Don't worry about that. This novel stuff, it's maybe a bit stretched too far. Did anyone ever kind of do what I wish someone had done with the bloody Kilroy Silk and go, yeah, too much,
it's,
too far?
It's not going to, yeah. They haven't yet. I mean,
good.
I'm sort of thinking, though, as ever, the whole telly side, I feel I'm quite realistic about it, which is, you know, I'm doing a lot of it at the moment because I'm there as somebody who talks about wine. But, you know, in time, whether that's sooner or later, I don't know when, it'll be somebody else's turn. And that's not my call. That's somebody somewhere saying, it's, you know, it's been lovely, but off you go. There's a new one now. And I guess I've always thought, I don't want to think of that as my as my main job because I'm not in control of it. Do you see what I mean? Whereas
no, I love it. It's really seriously is something that just, I am. That's a really lovely thing. I love that.
Yeah. Well, writing I'm in control of, and happily for me, luckily that first book did well, which meant there's two and three, and now there's going to be four and five. So that is going to keep me busy, and I always think about that as my. At the moment, it's my plan B that will sort of come up. When I'm not so busy elsewhere, I will have more time to do that, and I look forward to it. I don't ever want to be in the position where the media stuff stops and I'm left thinking, what do I do now? I want to be able to say, do you know what, that was brilliant, and I've loved every single second of it, but it's time to go and do something else.
I love it. I love it. And that's a... Oh, my gosh, that's a lovely kind of do lectures sort of way of looking at the world, actually, which is... Own what you are in control of, and you know, the rest of it is either gravy or not. You're living your best life. I've got two slightly dampening questions for you on the theme of living your best life. I'll do the easy one first, which is I even feel self-conscious saying this. It makes me feel a bit uncomfortable. What you talk about is about alcohol and drinking, and you know, you're called the Knackered Mother's Wine Club. You know, I've often used alcohol in a way that's not very healthy. I've used it to sort of, you know, hide or disguise my knackeredness and or my inability as a father. And I know lots of my friends who are knackered mothers who probably use alcohol in a, you know, more therapeutic way than a celebratory way. You must have come across it before. Where you're there, you're knackered mother's wine club, sets up a stall, and for some people, that's amazing and celebratory and fun. But for other people, maybe too much of a crutch and a. And a thing that creeps into a bit of a dark place.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to get your take on that.
Views on that. I wrote about it 10 years ago when I was writing the book. I was very clear from the start that, you know, at the time you often see, like in the paper, if there's a story about, you know, middle-aged women drinking too much and it's a woman on the sofa with a massive glass of wine and blah, blah, blah. And I mean, that is like, it's very often the narrative. And my point has always been, for me, is that I want every glass of wine that you have to count and for you to care, to think about what you're drinking. So connect with it in a way, know what it is and where it's from, who made it, why it tastes like it does. It kind of then makes it something that I hope you take time over doing. And I mean, my God, it, you know, in my early years, university years, 20s, you know, let's just say I cannot drink like I used to. And I haven't really been able to since I had kids because, you know, you can't function properly if you're constantly hungover. So my thinking was fine. I can't drink like I used to, but I don't want to do the whole, you know, nothing, everything to nothing. I also have a bit of an issue with the whole, you know, stopping completely, like the dry January. I'd rather you did it little and often than all or nothing. And I guess that's where I'm coming from with wine, is care about it enough so that you are not drinking any old rubbish. You are drinking something that is actually delicious. That does mean having to spend perhaps a little bit more than you might do, but then you're not going to drink it as fast anyway. Just trying to be more mindful about what you're drinking. That is what I hope to do. And, you know, there are definitely times when I have more than my weekly limit allowance, probably in one weekend. But those weekends are few and far between. Most of the time, most evenings, I will have a glass of wine. And that's it. And some evenings I don't have any, because I just think, do you know what, tonight I'm not really cooking anything that special. I don't want a wine that goes with it. I don't need it. But what I also don't want to do is compromise by, you know, thinking it's just that whole thing of trying to be sensible and responsible about it, which is something I've always had to do, having ever since being a supermarket buyer. I mean, it's drummed into you about making sure your messaging is very much about drinking responsibly. That's what I tried to do. And so going back to what you were saying, in the Nacka Mothers Wine Club, right then 10 years ago, I wrote, look, this is about caring about what you're drinking. And it's definitely not about drinking because you're knackered. It's your glass of wine is something to sit and savour and sit down with it and have 10 minutes to yourself whilst you think about what it is you're drinking. That's the idea.
Which is a very, very, very solid answer. Okay, well, I'm going to just ask you the question that's, honestly, Hals, you know this, the listener's about to find out about this. You've dealt with something that, I don't think many people have. I thank God they haven't. And, even talking about it makes me sort of well out of tears and feel quite uncomfortable even saying it. But you have dealt with something that is not least in the context of you being somebody that I do believe is living your best life. And that, again, I find it hard to talk about it. The thing that happened to you, which most people don't understand or know, is your brother was murdered, mm-hmm. age 25, in a horrific, violent, massively massive headline grabbing event. And it got, could you talk about it, please?
I can definitely talk about Tim. I would talk about Tim all day, every day, if I could. My gorgeous, gorgeous little brother, who, as you say, died very suddenly when he was 25. And it was the worst thing. And still, it's...
Can you just tell us what happened? Because even now, it's a shocking sort of story.
Yeah, so we were living in London at the time. I used to see him all the time. I was about 4 or 5 years older than him, but we lived not that far apart. This was before I was married, but we saw each other a lot, and he was just brilliant fun. He was, over 6 feet. He was, I know everyone says this, but he really was life and soul of the party, and there were a lot of parties. And he was great fun. And unfortunately, it was a real case of wrong place, wrong time. He was driving back from picking up his girlfriend from the station, and he drove back to his road in Battersea, and he was approached by two people who were from, it transpired, a carjacking gang, and they tried to steal his keys, and he did put up some resistance to that, and they stabbed him, and unfortunately he was stabbed in the heart and he died. 3 days later we had to turn his life support machine off, and it was obviously completely, completely hideous. I mean, hideous. But there are some things that have come out of that, which obviously it changed my life completely. It changed my parents' life, my sister, my whole family, my husband, Tim's girlfriend at the time, Gemma, who I'm still very close to and love dearly. It took, I would say, looking back, this is 20 years ago now. It was 21 years ago, so 2002 in January. And there are the positive ways that it has changed my life is I realized it for a long time. I felt underwater, like completely underwater. It's weird. You feel like you can see life going on around, but you can't quite hear anything, and you feel like you can't quite say anything. And so I lived in a tiny bubble of very close friends and family. And I did go back to work pretty soon afterwards and use that as a way of really just putting my focus elsewhere. But it was a really hard time. But I was very lucky to be surrounded by amazing friends and family. A lot of the people I spent time with in those first few years were very close to Tim as well. So it was almost like by being with people who were very close to him, you know, you just felt like you didn't have to explain anything. That sort of made it easier because everyone, we were all kind of going through a similar thing, but we all knew how brilliant he was. But after a while, I realized I was resurfacing. And the biggest thing that made that happen was having children. I mean, I didn't for quite a long time after he died, for obvious reasons. When I did then have George, which was about 4 years later, 3 or 4 years later, that brings you up to the surface pretty quickly, having kids. Like, suddenly I had to be present. And I feel like, you know, that was a real moment of making me kind of come out of it and thinking, right, what am I going to do? I just didn't want to live my life being really sad about what happened. Funnily enough, I never really felt angry about it. I think I was quite quickly, and without even realizing I'd done it, I always did look at it as a thing that happened that was so awful, but I knew I would never be able to explain it. Like, it really was a terrible thing, but nobody could have done anything for it not to happen, really. You know, he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And trying to do that, you'd drive yourself mad. So accepting that it happened was one thing, and then thinking, I can't live the rest of my life being angry about it. So I sort of went the other way, which is, okay, this awful thing has happened. So now I am going to make sure that I try and not take anything ever for granted ever again. And definitely not worry about the small things that used to worry me. You know, if I'm in a situation now and I don't like it, I get out of it. If I'm with somebody I don't like, who's not making me feel like me, I'll never be rude. I just know that life is too short. I'm going to change the situation. And so that is a very big lesson. There's a line in Spinal Tap, of all films, where one of the characters, I can't remember his name, but he says something like, you know, he says, you know, that gives it perspective. And the guy comes back and says, you know, yeah, too much fucking perspective, which that is a lot of perspective. But in terms of making me not sweat the small stuff for the rest of my life, that is a gift that Tim gave me. And of course, I would, you know, I miss him every single day. But I think he has given me this ability to just not worry about stuff, just do it and see what happens. Because what's the worst that can happen? You know, the worst that can happen has happened. So we just go on.
Find it hard to speak to tells. I really do. You know, this is amazing. And gosh, we're here talking about living your best life. I mean, look, I totally agree with you. I haven't dealt with that, and I fucking pray I never have to. It's, some people know my own problems with cancer, and you know, I say to everyone about having brushed with death, you just have to not sweat the small stuff. You have to get perspective. You have to realise that every day is a gift, and you know, treat it as such, and just do not get bogged down in the minutiae of nonsense. And celebrate every day, and frankly, you know, carpe diem, yeah, go for it.
You're living your best life.
I guess, you know, it's a funny way to end our chat about wine drinking, but I just want you to sort of stitch together in your best life to what you've learnt so far.
What I've learned so far is, yes, going back we're going back to the quote, you know, if you do something that you really love, then your days are going to be pretty good because you're spending your time doing something.
Is that the Rolf Harris quote?
That is. That is. I didn't want to bring Rolf up again, but it is there, what he said. But I also think that I wouldn't be doing this 20 years ago. Like, part of the reason why the last 10 years really has been as bonkers as it has was because all of these things happened to get me to a place where, at the time where I needed to not be scared and just go for it, that's what I did. And I still remind myself how lucky I am. Hence why when I am sitting there on live TV having a glass of wine with Gary Barlow, like I said, I don't take a second of it for granted. I think, this is amazing. I'm so lucky to be here. I'm going to enjoy every single second of it. Which I do, to the point where actually Matt Tebbutt did have to remind me to not sit quite so close to Gary Barlow. slightly invading his face.
I'd like to think I spotted that, but I don't think I did. But I'm going to go back over the film and just check that. He was wearing a very attractive jumper, though, wasn't he?
So that is the other thing, is he was wearing a fluffy jumper.
His knitwear was exceptional.
It was beautiful. Beautiful knitwear. Well, of course, I kept stroking it, which
Did you get a chance to sniff it? How did it smell?
Oh, he smells so nice. He smells so nice.
Oh, I knew that.
Gav, I cannot tell you how many messages I had from people saying, did he smell nice? Honestly, I'm like, yeah, that's just what everybody wants to know.
He looked like
he
smelt amazing. Sorry, overshare. Sorry, audience.
Very fragrant, man.
Oh my gosh!
But yes, it is. It's about not taking a second for granted. In fact, and actually, when you were saying those things just now, you know, you when you have had a brush with death, and it does give you that perspective. It's one thing saying it; it's another thing actually feeling it. And you do kind of then just feel it in your bones. One day, you're like, okay, fine. I'm just not going to do the stuff that I don't want to do anymore. I'm going to do the stuff I want to do, and I'm going to enjoy doing it.
And it's one of the hardest things to ever say to anyone else, because the moment you start saying it, you sound like a kind of dad, granddad. And I said it to my kids, I said to my friends, I said to my wife. You just sound like a patronising prick. But when you've been through it, as you have massively, and I have a tiny bit, it's a gift. You get a sense of, gosh, life is transient. It's, you know, it goes, and God, we've got to embrace it every day and just enjoy it and not be judgmental and just, you know, make the best of every day. And fuck me, Helen, you are doing that. And gosh, if there's ever anyone that epitomises living your best life than you, then, well, get them on the podcast. But, look, thank you so much for talking to me, to us. And, yeah, look, I really appreciate it. I think you've got an amazing story, and I'm very grateful. And let's get you back, because I'm sure there's more to talk about. Sorry about talking about Rolf Harris.
I tell you what, if you get me back, I'll see if Sooty or Sweet can make it.
Good. I like that. Anyway, Helen McGinn, thank you so much for being a guest on Living Your Best Life. Thank you.
Gav, thank you very much for having me. It's been a joy. Living your best life.
Thank you so much for listening, and thank you to Helen for being an amazing guest and for sharing how she lives her best life. I personally found the story, particularly the end of it, nothing short of inspirational. Again, sorry for over-living the wine bit myself. But yeah, I hope you found that interesting. Please do give us a rating. Please do leave us a review, and please do subscribe. It does help with the algorithm. And thank you for those people that have written in with some feedback and some suggestions. Please feel free, gav@thedolectures.co.uk.
The actual Do Lectures is coming up soon. It's next weekend if you're listening to this in real time. And yeah, I hope to meet some of you there. And if not, the next podcast will be out in 2 weeks' time. So thank you very much again for listening. This show was produced by Ashton Main. The music was also by Ashton Main, so thank you, Ash. And yes, see you in 2 weeks. Please stay safe, take care, and live your best life. Bye.
Living Your Best Life with Gav Thompson.